For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. For more information, visit faith.yale.edu. This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa.
And I'm Matt Crosman, and we are with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture.
Matt, thanks for joining me today to talk about what's worth wanting.
Glad to be here. This should be fun.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've been on the show before, but we're going to play a talk that you gave last year that is expressive of a really important line of thought in the Life Worth Living program that you run.
I'm really trying to get at like a challenge that Miroslav and I have talked about before in some of our writings. And I think we refer to David Foster Wallace on this problem. We say it's not just that we don't know how to live meaningful lives. David Foster Wallace says we don't even seem to be able to focus for very long on the question.
Yeah.
And there's something that is, there's something like the question itself sort of messes us up. And I wonder if it's worse than that we can't focus on the question. I wonder whether we can't even understand the question.
What causes that, do you think?
Well, I think that part of it and part of what sort of drives this talk is the sense that we have a bunch of easier questions that we're really, really quick to try to substitute for the really difficult one, right? So if we try to think about, as we often say, like what sort of life is worthy of our humanity, we're much more likely to try to swap that out to like, how can I live the life that I want? Or even just, what sort of life do I want? And once we reduce it to just like trying to explore our own preferences, then, I mean, certainly the question is easier to answer then, but it's not even, it's in no way the same question anymore. Even much less when we get it, reduce it just to sort of a question about like tactics or strategies or tips and tricks.
So cue us up a little bit. When did you give this talk? Tell us a little bit about your work at Grace Farms and what the connection there is.
Yeah, so I've given this talk many occasions. The one that we're going to hear is a version that I gave at the Grace Farms Foundation, which is a place where I serve one day a week as the Faith Initiative director. At the Grace Farms Foundation, the Faith Initiative is oriented around questions that will be familiar to listeners of this podcast. The fundamental question is, what is the shape of flourishing life? And we're trying to use, very much like in the Life Worth Living program, we're trying to use a sort of multiple different religious and non-religious traditions and sources and fragments of insight to try to give us some sort of leverage or some sort of insight into this fundamental question.
Matt, thanks for giving this talk. Thanks for joining us today to do this interview about it. And listeners, at the end of each section of the talk, we'll jump back in with some commentary from Matt. Enjoy.
I thought my whole life was planned out. I was to be a composer and a conductor of a major symphony orchestra, like many undergraduates before and since. And so I came to college those first days with my scores under my arm and my baton in my hand, the latter a gift from a mother who was positively giddy at having the need to purchase a conducting baton for her teenage son. And I spent a lot of time in college playing music, recording music, performing music, conducting music. Hardly a weekend would go by when I wasn't playing in a concert or playing a gig with a band or having a piece premiered and performed. Usually there was more than one such event on a given weekend. And I started to collect all of the posters and I would put them up on my wall, a growing monument to my own accomplishments, a parochially collegiate down payment on fame, on reputation that I was sure was going to come my way. Fortunately for me, I had a group of friends who cared more for me than they were impressed by me. And so they started to ask me questions about the aim, about the trajectory of my life, about what it was that I was after. And as they asked these questions, I started to realize, you know, I said I was all about music, but there was something else that was really driving me. I was more interested in being famous than in being good. And I mean that both in both senses. I mean, certainly I was more interested in fame than I was in being morally good, but I was more interested in fame than I was really concerned about how good the music was. And so as time went by, I became convinced that wasn't worth living for. Fame, reputation, those things weren't worthy of being the aim of my life. And try as I might, I just couldn't disentangle my attachment to music and my passion for music from this attachment to reputation, to fame. And so I took the posters down off the wall and I retired the baton. And eventually I stopped writing music, or at least I stopped performing it publicly. And I have to say, I'm still not 100% sure whether that was the most courageous or the most cowardly decision of my life. But in those days, it was clear to me there was something unworthy of my humanity that had staked out a place as the aim of my life. And I felt I needed to do whatever I could to starve it. Unsurprisingly, shifting professional aspirations didn't magically kill off this attachment to reputation. As it turns out, self-obsession is actually rather portable. You can take it with you wherever you go, into whatever sort of pursuit you might take up. And so I discovered what I'm sure that you have already realized. My problem wasn't music. My problem was my posture toward it. But it was an important moment in my life to put a stake in the ground and say, no more. This isn't worthy of my humanity, and so it can't be the aim of my life. And these days, my life looks different than I had imagined. It does for most people, looks different than what we imagine our lives will look like when we're young, when we're small. I spend my time convening and nurturing communities that do the sort of reflection that ruined, by which I mean saved, my life. And so I want to help us get a handle on exactly what sort of reflection this is. When I tell people that I teach a course called Life Worth Living, often the first thing that comes to people's minds is Socrates' dictum, the unexamined life is not worth living. And indeed, I'm all for examining our lives, but I take it that not all examination is created equal. If examination is significant, we need to ask ourselves, how should we examine our lives? And there are multiple answers to this question, many modes of examination, many habits of reflection, and this is as it should be. We need different modes of reflection at different times. Different of life's moments require different ways of reflecting, different questions to ask. The problem is, I'm not sure that we're very good these days at distinguishing between these different modes of reflection. And so today my goal is simple. I just want to disambiguate these seemingly synonymous questions to help us recover the most profound among them, because by ordering them properly, by putting the genuine question of the good life in its proper place, all of these questions find their place. And together, each of them can help us find our way to that life which is most truly worth living.
You talk about how you're not sure you're giving up your dream to be a composer was the most courageous or the most cowardly thing that you've ever done. And I think that connects with a lot of people. I mean, younger Gen X, millennials, and certainly younger generations, I think we grew up hearing that you could follow your dreams, that you could be whatever you want. And negating that saying that, no, you can't be whatever you want. And maybe what you want is errant in some way. That usually sounds villainous. And you could see how you'd still want to help kids achieve and exceed expectations and live up to their potential as human beings. Like, what do you make of the living your dreams or follow your dreams kind of language? And how do you relate it to the question of what's worth wanting?
Well, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. A lot of us sort of grew up with that, like, follow your dream, you can accomplish anything. And I mean, first of all, I think many of us figured out pretty quickly that that wasn't true. just because you want to do it doesn't mean you can like chase down, go down whatever path you choose. The fundamental question is, for me, do I have the right dreams? Are my dreams, I mean, the right one, that I know that sounds so antithetical to everything we think about dreams. Dreams are sort of self-validating. But once I came to that moment of realizing I've been captured, or at least I'm in danger of being captured by a dream that is not worthy of my life's devotion. I mean, once you realize that, then this question of sort of the worthiness of your dreams, I think, is front and center, right? And so that's a different, you know, that's a different question even than I think the one that many of us have struggled with. That's the question of, is this dream really mine? You know, was it given to me by someone else? Was it sort of foisted upon me by, you know, some sort of societal expectation or whatnot? But even if it really is mine, is it actually worthy of my whole life's trajectory? I mean, I in certain ways, I can only speak, you know, most straightforwardly for myself. I that was my experience in that moment, in sort of thinking about this sort of assumed music career for myself. That path was, I realized, at least in the way that I was invested in it, it wasn't a dream sort of worthy of all that I was investing in it. And the reason I say, you know, for what it's worth, the reason that I say I'm not sure if it was the most courageous or the most cowardly thing I've ever done is simply that, you know, one response is the one that I gave. You walk away and you say, well, I don't want to be invested in this in this way, so I'm just not gonna I'm gonna turn my attention elsewhere. Maybe the more difficult, maybe the more courageous task would actually be to say, is there some way of being invested on this path in a way that is worthy of my humanity, and sort of staying in the game, as it were, staying, sort of writing music, making music, doing that in ways that, that weren't about this sort of self-obsession, but were, about, the community that music can create, about the access to transcendence that a musical, piece can offer, pursuing those sorts of paths. Maybe that's actually the harder work.
So I want to describe to you four different modes of being in the world, four different ways of being in the world. And you need to hear this. No mode is bad in and of itself. All four of these modes need each other. And we experience these four as layers. That is, we generally move between adjacent layers. We don't skip around. As we move into deeper reflection, and we move into deeper layers. When we move toward action, and this too we must do, we move into higher layers. Each layer depends on the layers below it. That is, each layer depends on the answers to the questions that have been given at the layers below, even or especially when we haven't given those answers explicitly. And so if we haven't answered a question, nevertheless, everything we do, everything we say, everything we think shows evidence of some answer to this unanswered deeper question. We live answers to the deep questions of life, even if we couldn't give those same answers if we were asked for them point blank.
That's a really fascinating psychological claim. We live answers to the deeper questions, even if we couldn't give you those answers if we were asked point blank. What do you mean by it? I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit on like that observation.
Well, look, as theologians, as philosophers, as scholars, we're inclined to like to think about these things in highly sort of cognitivist sorts of ways, right? We think about ideas and thoughts and sort of convictions and the role of the mind. And I don't want to, and this talk is still rather cognitivist, and what can I do? I can't escape that sort of impulse. But the fact is that we have a lot. Some of the most important knowledge that each one of us has is what we might call tacit knowledge, right? It's the sort of knowledge that that remains sort of silent to us, that we don't even realize we know that we have, or there are convictions that we don't even know that we have. And because it's because they operate at that level of intuition, at that level of habit. I take it that like when we do take a step back and we think about that from a more sort of cognitive, theological, philosophical sort of point of view, we can see that, whoa, we have some really complex and deeply held convictions that are deeply motivating for our lives that we may never have even said out loud before. They're just living there sort of tacitly embedded in our everyday actions, in our everyday behaviors, in our habits, in our impulses and instincts. But that doesn't mean, just because we can't articulate them doesn't mean that they're not real. Doesn't mean that they're not fundamentally shaping the way that we live our lives. In fact, they may be more powerful in shaping our lives precisely because they're able to sort of hide under the surface.
Yeah, I love the invitation of this. It's a sort of invitation to begin the process of exploration to the deep that you are talking about here.
So the first surface layer is what I'll call the autopilot. This is the layer where we simply do what we do because that's what we do. When we're living only in this layer, we're not even sure of why we do what we do. Perhaps we're in a state of flow. We're deeply engaged in one or another embodied practice. At this layer, life is lived out of the sort of knowledge that lives in our muscles and in our bones. It lives in our bodies. The machinery of our lives, individually and collectively, just keeps churning, and we care not why. Much of life is lived here, up at the surface. And this is as it should be. In the best case scenario, what we do this way is finely tuned to give us the results that we want. And the results that we want are actually worth wanting. In this case, our autopilot reflects our deepest values and indeed what is true independent of our values. If so, we're the sort of people whom Aristotle would call wise. He compares practical wisdom to that of a shipbuilder, except that in this case, instead of the thing that our hands knowing to do being building a ship, what our hands know to do, what our body, what our whole self knows to do is to build a good life. May all of us someday find ourselves in this situation. But a state of flow, a state of embodied practical wisdom isn't the only time when we do what we do simply because it's what we do. The autopilot runs our lives whenever we aren't all that reflective about our actions. This is the infamous unexamined life. So this layer can also be the one in which in our collective lives, say in an institution that we work for, our daily routine has no deeper justification than simply the answer, that's how we've always done it. And it doesn't take groupthink to start to think this way. We can just as well live this way all on our own. Cut off from deeper modes of reflection, this mode becomes a matter of mindless routine. The machine keeps churning, and we know nor really care why. This should be troubling to us. And in fact, we've probably all experienced this mode of living, this way that it can make us feel stuck and in desperate need of taking a step back and considering our habits. We know that feeling of relief when finally someone bursts into the room and says, well, hold on, is what we're doing actually getting us what we want? Or maybe the more pragmatic version of the diagnostic question, it would be, how can we get more of what we want? Whichever form it takes, this is the effectiveness question. And this is the heart of all the design thinking that's so in vogue these days. And if the autopilot isn't getting us where we want to go, it's a great relief when finally this question appears on the scene. We're able to step back and to reflect on our actions and consider whether they're really getting us what we're after. For organizations, this can be a watershed moment in which our daily routines are centered and tuned around our goals. There's a helpful ruthlessness within this layer. That's how we've done it, just no longer cuts it as an answer, as a justification. New processes are designed, new practices are cultivated. If we're doing it right, reflection at this layer streamlines our daily routines and directs our energies. As a team, we then say, we're now pulling all in the same direction. After a season invested in reflection in this layer, we can switch back to autopilot with the knowledge that our new habits will yield the results that we're after. Now, the disadvantage of this layer of reflection is that it's what a philosopher might call ends agnostic. That is, there's nothing here that's concerned with whether the goals that we have are the right goals, or even frankly, whether they're our goals. An efficient system gets you more of what you want, whatever it is. And that can actually be dangerous if you haven't thought all that hard about what it is that you're after. I mean, think about it. An effective strategy for focusing exclusively on your professional goals at the expense of the relationships that are most significant to you, that effective strategy is actually worse for you than an ineffective one. If your ends are bad, then more effective means is hardly the solution. Now, I give that example, and it sounds ridiculous, but the fact is that many of us live our lives never going much deeper than these top two layers. The effectiveness question strikes us as the most insightful question that there is. And we marvel at those who are able to master it. Silicon Valley captivates our collective imagination because its firms churn out products and services that can do anything. They are masters of effectiveness. In fact, I take it a great lie of the 21st century is that the effectiveness question is the most profound question that we can ask. The truth is closer to this. These days, the effectiveness question is the most profound question many of us can answer.
Probably one of the more uncomfortable truths of this talk is around our current culture's obsession with effectiveness. You say, if your ends are bad, then more effective means is hardly the solution. And that just hits really hard as a sort of undermining factor for all of the efficiency obsession. You also say that the great lie of the 21st century is that the effectiveness question is the most profound question we can ask. The truth is, it's merely the most profound question we're able to answer. So we've stopped woefully short. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about why we have done that. Why have we settled?
I think we've settled in large part because we know that we're not up to the greater task. This is a sort of strategy for avoiding the limits of our own our competence vis-a-vis the most important questions of our lives. We can trade effectiveness tips back and forth all day long without having to agree on the ends that we're going to use them toward. And that's a sort of compromise socially that like makes for like more comfortable dinner conversation, or maybe even makes for like, you know, listicles that can get passed around super broadly or among people who don't necessarily agree on the fundamental questions in life, but we can all trade like life hacks and little tips and tricks.
It makes us feel more productive, probably, when you feel like you like can answer. I mean, you brought this up earlier, when you feel like you can answer those simpler questions, it's maybe a means of avoiding or just keeping ourselves busy.
Yeah. And I think in certain ways, like the whole modern world that we live in is evidence of the success of these sorts of procedural approaches to life, right? Where we don't have to agree in a democracy about what is just or good. We just have votes on it, and we take the vote to sort of amount to something close enough to the good. We don't have to decide, even if you're on a jury, you don't have to decide about guilt or innocence of a person. You just have to like apply the law correctly. It's just, you just follow the procedure in the marketplace. So nobody has to determine the value of anything anymore. We just have like a procedure through which we arrive at a price for something. And the price, we take it to be close enough to an approximation of value. And, you know, whoever wins the vote, we take to be a closest enough approximation of what's good or what's just. And same thing for the jury. And in certain ways, those are all like what we have is we've created, like the whole modern world is just a collection of really, really effective means. And I mean, look, some of those means landed men on the moon. I mean, we actually are pretty good at like taking sort of any arbitrary end and just like iterating to the point where we get like effective means. And I don't want to talk down about that at all. It's remarkable. Just to say, that's our area of strength as a society, as an age. So it's totally reasonable to me that we are much more comfortable sort of playing on our strong turf than on these more profound questions that are really start to immediately expose our sort of societal weaknesses.
But most of us have experienced here and there in our lives a yet more significant question. A question that can save us from the ens agnosticism of lives lived only in the effectiveness layer. And that is the question, what do we really want? I mean, it's all well and good to know how to get more of what we want, but the more important question is, what are we really after? Where are we really trying to go? This is the self-awareness question, a question that invites us into a process of introspection. From the hustle and bustle of the autopilot and the strategic tuning of life in the effectiveness question, we arrive at a quieter place, looking inward. We stop being distracted by what's most easily accomplished and instead ask what it is that we really want. Rather than valuing what's most easily measured, what's most easily demonstrated to be effective, we take stock of what it is that we truly value most. And the deeper we probe here, the more we apply this question recursively, asking again and again, what do we want? What do we really want? What are we really after? The more we come to realize that what we want isn't just a set of discrete things or discrete outcomes or even a set of character traits. What we want is actually more holistic than that. What we want is what we're chasing after, what our lives are aimed at, is some vision of a good life, some vision of flourishing life. The sort of life that we want for ourselves, that we want for our children or other young people whom we care about, the sort of life that we want to make possible for our world as a whole to live in. Of course, that vision is capacious. When I say a vision of flourishing life, I don't mean a life that specifies every little detail of a life. I mean the broad strokes. I mean what it is that we imagine when we imagine life led well, a life going well, a life feeling like it should. And even at the level of the broad strokes, though, this vision still entails choices. And at this level, at this layer, the choices are ours. Do we want a life of ecstatic joy or a life of peaceful serenity. Perhaps what we want is a life lived with courage, or rather a life perhaps that leaves room for the other. Maybe we treasure a life of abundant provision, or perhaps a life that has just enough. Do we prize a life of independence, or rather a life of interdependence? Choices abound, and at this level, the choices are ours. For this reason, the self-awareness level can actually be a lonely place. As we probe the depths of our own intuitions, our own preferences, there is no escaping the fact that these visions and our reasons for preferring them are our own. Even when we do this sort of reflection together with a community in a group, we come to realize that our collective vision, whatever it is, our collective vision is inescapably ours. It may not be compelling to those on the outside, no matter how compelling it is to us. And yet, if we want to live with integrity, we will need to orient the rest of life, our strategies and our habits, around this vision of life toward which we're oriented. That is, the task in this layer is to explicitly orient our lives around that which our lives were already oriented implicitly. But even in the midst of a substantially actualized self-awareness, many of us have experienced the dissatisfaction that can creep in. This is the feeling that comes in moments of mid and quarter life crises. Many of my undergraduates actually arrive in my classroom already in a moment of quarter life crisis. They've spent years trying to put together the sorts of resumes that are going to get them into the college of their dreams. And then they arrive on campus and they look around. And first of all, they see a whole bunch of other people who also managed to get into this locked door, get through this locked door, find their way into this good life. And second, they're wondering, wait, shoot, is this it? Is this what all that I was working for? What now? Where do I aim my efforts? And whether or not we've been in this place ourselves, we know someone who has. And when it comes down to it, we have the sneaking suspicion that if our lives go as we want them to, I mean, these are actually ironically privileged places, privileged problems. But if our lives go as we want them to, we will land in this place eventually. This is the place where we have a life oriented around getting us what we want. And in large part, we have it. And yet, there's still something missing. And asking the effectiveness question doesn't help. In fact, the ruthlessness with which we've pursued our chosen vision of the good life seems itself to be part of the problem. And asking the self-awareness question won't help either. I mean, we could try to apply recursively the lesson that we learned in the self-awareness level, asking recursively again and again, what do I want? What do I really want? What do I really, really, really want? But that quickly becomes a never-ending loop of introspective navel-gazing. The answer, sadly, is not within. The fact is, we wouldn't be where we are if we didn't really want whatever it is that we have now found wanting.
So navel-gazing, that's insufficient. And the answer is not within. Say a little bit more about this, because you know that this, again, this is not a popular position. You're up against a tidal wave of Disney films and self-help gurus.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, I try to, whenever I talk about this, I try to like go there with people to really enter into. I recognize like this is a place of disappointment, right? Like I understand that like I'm like letting us all down here.
I don't know about that, because I think there's the suspicion that what you're saying is in fact the truth, and perhaps like this tidal wave is there to, again, it's a form of like denial or some kind of like self-deception that, I don't know, that the answer is might be within gives us some kind of hope for some reason.
Yeah, that could be, because I take it that all of us, to some degree or another, we have some sense of accountability, some sort of responsibility to something outside ourselves, even if what we feel responsible to is some truest version of ourselves. Interesting that you even bring up the Disney films. You know, maybe someday we'll get a chance to talk about this, because one of our colleagues, Ryan McAnally-Lins, and I have gone back and forth, and we do this with our students every year now, thinking about Disney films and what Disney films actually do say about this sort of question of whether the answer is just within. And I take it that the you know, not to spoil that conversation, but I take it that the best of these films actually do give us some sort of external referent against which our own individuality becomes significant. So my favorite of this is Moana, right? Who discovers that to the extent to which her answer is within, it's because what is within her, her truest self, is actually herself as constituted by her people and by her real material relationship with her community and with the history of that community through the ages. Mm-hmm. In any case, all of these sorts of accounts, I think, sort of point us to the fact that we know that the answers aren't simply within us, and even the answer that we find within is itself indexed to something beyond the self. And that can be... That can sort of burst our sort of self-help hopes, but I take it can also be deeply relieving if we've been on this sort of self-help merry-go-round too many times, going around asking, you know, is this what I want? Is this what I really want? Is this what I really, really, really want? And we can sort of get caught in that place and sort of feel the arbitrariness. Again, Miroslav and I have written about this. We talk about the sort of demon of arbitrariness, this little devil who sits on our shoulder and says that if it really is just all within and all down to us, then how are our desires and our life orienting visions not just purely arbitrary? How can that really be enough to build our lives on? And so I think it actually can be relieving to finally say, all right, I admit it. My life is accountable. I am responsible to something beyond myself, something presumably mysterious, something that I will never be able to master, but something that I can look toward, and I can enter into various sorts of communities that'll help me discern the nature of that sort of beyond to which my life is accountable.
No, the only question suited to these moments, the question with which we ought to familiarize ourselves sooner rather than later, lest we maroon our lives on the reef of effectively actualized self-awareness. That question is not what do we want, but rather what is worth wanting. And this is a question hardly ever whispered in many corners, much less posed in all earnestness. Here we have entered the layer of self-transcendence. And if the self-awareness question pointed you to a vision of a good life that oriented your life, your compass, set your trajectory, and the effectiveness question asked you about the reliability of your strategy in delivering the goods of that life to you, then the self-transcendence question asks you about the validity of that vision. It asks you, is this vision, in fact, worthy of my humanity? This question asks you, is that vision of a good life, that vision of life that you want for yourself, your children, your community, is that vision true? Is your vision of a good life, in fact, a vision of the true life? Has your compass properly identified true north? In the language of desire, we would say, is what you really want actually worth wanting? The self is no longer at the center of our quest. We are no longer the point. In fact, quite the opposite. This question aims to push us out of the center. And at these depths, the name of the game is normative inquiry, the erstwhile realm of theology and philosophy. And actually, I take it that every humanities course you ever took should have, at least in part, been about helping you learn to ask and begin to answer this question. My hunch is that a number of literature classes probably did do that for you. In dealing with questions of truth, we have to learn a different strategy, a different posture towards the world, a different mode of reflection. And the good news is that if the self-awareness question led us into sort of isolation, then in the self-transcendence layer, we find that we are not so alone after all. Here, others are again in view, for the question that we ask in this layer has to do with them as well. In fact, we may find that these others are actually sort of troublesome because we have to contend with one another about the answers that we give, about the claims that we make to the truth. Even while we seek the truth, even the universal truth, we know that our own claims are, in fact, particular. Not everyone comes to the conclusions that we do. And if we don't attend well to this particularity and pursue charity in our contestation with one another over the shape of our lives and over the truth of our claims about the vision of life that we're aiming for, then our expeditions to this depth will have yielded nothing more than mere ideology. But it's not just our contemporaries that come into view at this level. The ancients reappear as well. When we begin to ask normative questions about the good life, we find that while we're perhaps in uncharted territory for ourselves, we're actually right in the thick of a conversation about the nature of flourishing life that has been going on for thousands of years. And so Moses and Plato and Confucius and the Buddha and Jesus, the prophet Muhammad, to say nothing of more recent thinkers from Mary Wollstonecraft to Nietzsche to James Baldwin. All these voices have been asking this question, what is worth wanting, long before we stumbled upon it? And actually, where theologians and philosophers have faltered, often it is artists who have picked up the slack. Now, whoever we're interacting with, whoever we're reading, whoever's work we're considering, whoever's way of life we're encountering, these folks' answers probably can't simply be our answers. That would be to ignore the question of self-awareness to which we'll have to attend on our way back up to the surface. But their answers can help us, the ways that they pose the questions, perhaps even more so. And in their and in one another's presence, we will find that the question of the truth of the good life can be posed and begun to be answered in all seriousness.
So you say in this section of the talk, is this vision you want, is that vision worthy of your humanity? Is it true? You also say, is what you want really worth wanting? And so this is your way of offering that transcendence to someone who's caught at the third level of just self-awareness. So the question here, I think, is how do you cultivate life at this level? Some people might feel ill-equipped. Some people just feel exhausted after too much time spent at this depth. But especially if the question stays real, as in you consider other answers, you know, people change their minds about these transcendent questions, experience conversions. Say a little bit about how life at this level remains livable and how you guide students, how you guide people through it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we have the sense that these questions are sort of beyond our pay grade, then my response is to say, indeed. good. That's one of the first things I think that we should feel when we sort of get down here. And if we feel like we aren't equipped to answer these questions, again, I take it that's just an honest self-assessment.
Sort of beginner's mind.
Yeah. I mean, the first sense that we're like, we're never going to master this is probably just never going to go away. That just we carry with us forever. But then there are sort of ways that that second sort of like, I haven't done the right sort of training for this. I think that's also true, but maybe we can do a little bit more about that, right? So we can learn to ask these questions better. We can learn from the world's great traditions, what it would be to take on these questions and to begin to answer them. We can learn about the sort of interconnectedness between the various sort of constituent questions. I mean, so one of the first things we do in the class is we take this big, big question of what's worth wanting or what sort of life is worthy of our humanity. And we immediately break it down, right, into 6 or 7 or 8 different sort of component questions. And so that's one strategy, right? You can sort of break it down. You can begin to sort of learn better how to ask these questions. But you also get a sense of like how like the answer to the question, to whom are we responsible for living our lives a certain way, is deeply connected to another question about, what's the role of suffering in a good life. And so you can get we can learn the questions better. We can learn how the questions relate to one another better. We can learn the sorts of questions that the world's great traditions have given over the millennia to these questions. I take it we have to learn to live with two virtues that we have to hold in tension. On the one hand, we have to live with humility, which is that sort of sense that, we're never going to master this. We're never going to get this like figured out. We're going to have to sort of like hold our hands open. And even whatever we think we may have sort of puzzled out or figured out, or whether stroke of insight has somehow come to us, we're going to have to hold that with open hands. But at the same time, we're going to have to balance that with courage to nevertheless take whatever it is that we're holding with open hands and to act courageously in the world, to take risks with our actions and our ultimately with our lives for the sake of what we take to be most worthy of our humanity. And that's a really hard tension to hold. It's much easier to sort of fall into sort of life of so-called courage only, which can look like the sort of, you know, ready, fire, aim sort of life of the stereotypical American cowboy sort of approach to life. It's easy to have so-called courage without any humility, but I also think it's possible to end up with a sort of humility only sort of life where it's sort of paralysis by analysis. If we instead, I think the key down at this lowest level is to learn alongside whatever we're like substantively learning about these questions and their answers, to learn these sorts of virtues of intellectual humility and intellectual courage alongside each other.
Now, after we have plumbed these depths, there is still a return voyage to be made. Apprehending the truth of the matter does us no good if we don't appropriate this truth as our own. The truth of self-transcendence needs to become the vision of self-awareness. And any work that we do at these deeper layers remains just esoteric knowledge unless we have effective strategies to implement what we've learned in our daily lives. Our lives can only ever be lived so intentionally, so we need practices that can give expression to our insights. What we've learned with our minds needs to be inscribed in our bodies. Indeed, minds and bodies aren't so simply related that way. But we're actually going to need to take lots of these different dives. Like many processes, this is one that we're, I think, going to want to repeat. And sometimes on some of these dives, what we're going to want to reflect on underneath the water is whether our practices up above the surface aren't actually smarter than some of our best ideas. Often returning to the surface will feel just like that. A return to a place where we can breathe. While it would be foolish never to go under the water and to probe even the depths of the water, it would be equally foolish to try to live our whole lives underneath the water's surface. Such life, as you might imagine, can feel suffocating. But if we learn to take these dives with some regularity, dives of different depths, no doubt, but dives that never neglect the deepest waters entirely. If we're able to learn to do these, all three of these modes of reflection, and through them encounter the fundamental question of our lives: what is worth wanting? What life is in fact worthy of our humanity? Then we may indeed find our way, individually and collectively, into flourishing life.
Matt, that was a fantastic talk, but we don't get too much detail from you here at the end about that return voyage to the surface. So I wonder if you'd maybe say a little bit about that here. What does that entail? And tell me your thoughts about moving back toward from the level of truth into like visions of good life, into strategies and effectiveness, which do have their place, and then ultimately habits and practices.
So you're not wrong. There's an emphasis here, and maybe this sort of deserves a whole second talk.
I think it does. Let's see it.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I might not be the right person to give that talk. You're getting this sort of the cognitivist intellectualist sort of side of this, right? Which is always going to want to be driving down to the bottom. But you know, my experience though has been over the years that actually, like, you know, when I say like you can actually end up sort of drowning if you stay down at the bottom, it can feel suffocating. And it really is like, I think a really important piece. Like, we're not always going to be living down at the bottom. We shouldn't always be living down at the bottom. In fact, I'm not even sure that every like dive, as it were, needs to go all the way to the bottom. When we come back up, there's really, really important work to be done. We have to take whatever we take to be true and figure out how to turn that, how to embed that within our desires. That's maybe the piece of this that I am sort of most passionate about these days, because I think that's a piece that, as modern Westerners, we're sort of disinclined to ever think about. For us, like, once you like are bought into something, then of course you're like bought in. But to the ancients, it'd be really, really clear that like, just because you believe something is true, or just because something is true, doesn't mean that all of a sudden your desires are going to be oriented around it. So there's this whole category, right, of disciplines, of the sort of activity that we engage in with the hope of shaping our hearts. Of shaping our desires, actually changing what it is we want, not treating what we want as that like sacred thing, that sacred deposit of our truest selves that should never be touched, but precisely thinking about it as something that we should actively be, a component of ourselves that we should actively be trying to norm against whatever we take to be most truly worthy of our humanity, but all the way up, right? That return journey is just so, so important, because otherwise our insights remain sort of esoteric puzzlings of, you know, people who like to think deep thoughts and feel good about that. If we're thinking a lot about what it is to live a good life, we better at some point get down to the business of living good lives. And it's not as easy as just saying, well, this is what I now believe to be true. Now I'm just going to go do it. There are just many processes along the way of reforming the heart, reforming our strategies, reforming our habits.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Matt, to talk about this. I'm looking forward to both further deep dives and returning to the surface together. Thanks for this work.
Likewise, this has been a blast.
For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured Matt Crosman, director of the Life Worth Living program at Yale College. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, and you can subscribe through any podcast app. We hope you're enjoying the show, and we hope that you'd consider supporting us. Three ways that you can do that are as follows. You can share the show with a friend by text or email, and then I hope you talk about it. You could post it on your social feed, or you could open up Apple Podcasts right now, just after listening, to review and rate the show. Now, we're asking you to share and support us because maintaining human connection is really important these days. We were not meant to live at distance from one another. So we hope this show is just a small, consistent way you can keep connecting, keep growing, keep seeking a life that is worthy of our shared humanity. We'll be back with more this coming week. Thanks, friends.